This is day one of this August 2009 two-day session, and I'm going to be reading from a book by Charlotte Joko Beck. I've read from her before, and there's a reason. I think she really, what she presents is really direct and really to the point, especially helpful for people in early sessions and for those of us who've done quite a few. Joko Beck was a student of Maizumi Roshi at the Zen Center in Los Angeles and a Dharma heir of his, I believe, and a teacher for many years in San Diego. She's written a couple of books. The first one is called Everyday Zen, and this one that I'm reading from is called Nothing Special, Living Zen. It's Charlotte Joko Beck with Steve Smith, evidently a student of hers who helped her with the book. I'm just going to read a few different, it's divided up into little sections. I think they're based on talks of hers that have been transcribed. And I'm going to read from a few of them and comment. So this first one is entitled Coming to Our Senses. And she says, she begins, "We all desire wholeness. We want to be whole persons. We want a sense of completeness. We want to be at rest in our lives. We try to figure out this problem, to think our way to wholeness. The effort never works. We need a different approach." We can't think our way through. She says, suppose we're hiking in the mountains and we sit down by a stream. What would it mean to be whole in this moment? And one of her students, various of her students, put in their answers. One says, being whole would mean feeling the air on my skin and hearing the sounds. And she says, yes. And another student says, thinking about myself. Not the best answer. And she says, when we think about ourselves, we separate ourselves from our experience and we're no longer whole. And then another student pipes in, feeling myself sitting on the ground, making contact with the leaves and soil, observing myself, thinking about myself. She says, yes, that's awareness. And another student says, seeing the stream, smelling the natural smells of the earth, feeling the sun on my back. And she says, yes, these are also part of the experience. And then finally a student says, feeling what is not present. For example, when I'm in a peaceful place, I may feel the absence of pain. That's a good feeling, that there is no pain. And she says to that, that's a kind of thinking that takes us away from awareness or wholeness. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's still extra. It's as if in the middle of appreciating a beautiful sunset, we say, oh, this is a beautiful sunset. We've slightly removed ourselves. And then she goes on to try to make her point a little more clearly. When we're sitting by the stream, we probably won't be having sensations of taste. But supposing we're eating Thanksgiving dinner, an idea this talk may have been given around Thanksgiving, it's surprising how few people actually taste the food they eat. It's amazing how much of our life just goes right by. We're accustomed to it. We're accustomed to not tasting what we're eating, not seeing what's in front of us, not hearing when people speak to us. What are we doing? We're up in our head. We're thinking. We're following this stream of chatter that we've made the focus of our life. It's nearly universal, I think, for people to do this, to get caught up in the drama running through their head. Joko says, if we're just sitting by the stream and sensing all there is to sense, it's no big deal. We're just sitting there. Suppose, however, we begin to think about our troubles in life. We become absorbed in our thoughts, poring over how we feel about our problems and what we can do about them, and suddenly we're oblivious to everything we were sensing a moment ago. We no longer see the water, smell the woods, feel our body. The sensations are gone. We have sacrificed our life in this moment in order to think about things that are not present, not real, here and now. I went to a sesshin once many years ago in Madison. I was driving back. The sky was absolutely astounding. Just blue with clouds piled up and wonderful sunlight. I noticed the other drivers around me were just totally lost in thought, and no one seemed to be aware that we were driving through this Buddha realm. And of course, I had just been to sesshin, so I was especially attuned to that, I felt. And then about 2 hours later, I happened to look up and notice that the sky still looked like that, and I'd forgotten all about it. It only takes a minute to wander off track, but you can spend a long, long time wool gathering, lost in thought. She says, the next time you're eating Thanksgiving dinner, or any meal for that matter, ask yourself whether you are truly tasting your food. For most of us, the experience of eating a meal is at best partial. Of course, this doesn't apply just to eating. There's just so many opportunities to tune in to what we're doing, walking down the street. Just an excellent example. Any kind of manual work that we're doing. Just to be in touch with the sweep of a broom or pulling on a rake. But even watching TV. How many people watch TV with sort of half of their attention or use it just to sort of numb out? You can watch in a different way. If you're watching TV with complete attention, if you're absorbed in what you're seeing and hearing, that's different from just sort of half paying attention and pulling another handful of popcorn out of the bowl. Of course, the other thing to bear in mind is you can spend your whole time beating yourself up about how you're not completely present. There's another way to wiggle out of being there. This isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. It's when you realize that you're not fully present, there's nothing extra you have to do. Just listen, look, feel. The commentary is totally gratuitous. There's no need to make a comment. There's no need to form a judgment about yourself, either good or bad. Look how aware I am, where everybody else around me is half asleep. Look how foggy and distracted I always am when everyone else around me is totally concentrated and probably deeply enlightened. She says, without awareness of our sensations, we are not fully alive. Life is unsatisfactory for most people because they are absent from their experience much of the time. This being absent, there's nothing morally wrong with being distracted, with not paying attention. It's just a really lousy way to live. There's also nothing unusual about it. Most people live that way. Most people start practice that way. And most people probably continue practice for many, many years that way, not fully present. the only lever we have is in this moment. All we can do is be here, be now. If you're continually coming back to the thought of, I've been working for so long, I still don't have Kensho, what's wrong with me? If you keep coming back to that, it's a total mistake. What you're looking for, what everyone is looking for, whether they've formed an idea of enlightenment or not, is this moment. This is life, not an idea about life. So again, she says, life is unsatisfactory for most people because they are absent from their experience much of the time. If we've been sitting for several years, we do it somewhat less. I don't know anyone who is fully present all of the time, however. We are like the fish that's swimming about looking for the great ocean of life, yet oblivious to its surroundings. Like the fish, we wonder about the meaning of life, not awake to the water all around us and the ocean that we are. The fish finally met a teacher who understood. The fish asked, "What is the great ocean?" And the teacher simply laughed. Why? So here comes a student. Because the fish was already in the ocean and just didn't realize it. Yes, the ocean was its life. Separate a fish from water, and there is no life for the fish. Likewise, if we separate ourselves from our life, which is what we see, hear, touch, smell, and so on, we have lost touch with what we are. Our life is always just this life. Our personal commentary on life, all the opinions we have about it, is the cause of our difficulties. We wouldn't be upset if we weren't leaving out our life. If we weren't leaving out the hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the kinesthetic sense of just feeling our body, we couldn't be upset. Why is that? And the student says, because we're in the present. Yes, we can't be upset unless our mind takes us out of the present into unreal thoughts. Whenever we're upset, we're literally out of it. We've left something out. We're like a fish out of water. When we're present, fully aware, we can't have a thought such as, oh, this is such a difficult life. It's so meaningless. If we do this, we've left something out, just like that. It's such a milestone just to realize this, to realize that what she's saying is true. So often when some sort of thought about why is my life so hard, why are people so unfair, why am I such a failure, Those thoughts seem to have traction. They seem to be, they grab us. They're about us and our life. They're so important. We wanna refute them or find a way to accommodate them. They're pointing us away from what we're looking for. We won't find the answer by thinking. Of course, we won't find the answer through denial either. If we've screwed up, there it is. We've screwed up. You need to take that in. But need to hear the birds calling. Hear the crickets. A good student recognizes when he or she has drifted away and returns to immediate experience. Sometimes we just shake our head and reestablish the basis of our life, the foundation in experience. Out of that foundation will come perfectly adequate thinking, action, creativity. It's all born in this space of experiencing, just letting the senses be open. It's our resting place that isn't a place where we rest immobile. We all have this desire to get to some place safe, to finally be done with all our struggle. There isn't such a place. Things are always changing and moving. We never know what's coming next. Our place of rest is a place of openness, a place of receptiveness. And when we come to trust that, nothing special, this simple thing that everyone can do, to see, to hear, to feel, to taste. When we have faith in that, then our practice takes on a different character, a different life. It's no longer this anxious striving. It's no longer this preoccupation with sizing ourselves up. It's all born in this space of experiencing, just letting the senses be open. She goes on, when I was 16 or 17 years old, I liked to play Bach chorales on the piano. One that I particularly loved was called In Thine Arms I Rest Me. The translation goes on, foes who would molest me cannot find me there. Though it is from the Christian tradition, which is often dualistic, this chorale is about being present and aware. There is a place of rest in our lives, a place where we must be if we are to function well. This place of resting, the arms of God, if you will, is simply here and now, seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting our life as it is, and totally alive. We can even add thinking to the list, if we understand thinking is simply functional thinking rather than ego thinking based on fear and attachment. Just thinking in the functional sense includes abstract thinking, creative thinking, or planning what we have to do today. Too often, however, we add non-functional ego-based thinking, which gets us into trouble and takes us from the arms of God. A life that works rests on these six legs, the five senses plus functional thought. When our lives rest on these six supports, no problem or upset can reach us. Of course, problems and upsets do reach us. But when they do, you can be sure we've left these six supports. She says it's one thing to hear a Dharma talk on these truths, however, and another to live by them. The minute something upsets us, we fly into our heads and try to figure it out. We try to regain our safety by thinking. Thinking is our first strategy. It's sort of our default. The minute something goes wrong, boom, up in the head. Over time, after practicing for a long time, this doesn't happen quite so often. It can settle into our gut. It's a gradual process. Even if there's awakening, we still have these same tendencies, and there's still this gradual process of purifying the mind and coming more and more to trust in things as they are, and to be in tune with things as they are. Again, she says, we try to regain our safety by thinking. We ask how we can change ourselves or something outside ourselves, and we're lost. To reestablish our lives on a secure foundation, we have to return to these six legs of reality over and over and over again. That's all the practice we need. If I have the faintest thought of irritation about anybody, the first thing I do is not to begin figuring out in my mind how to fix the situation, but simply ask myself, can I really hear the cars in the alley? Can I hear the plane flying overhead? My daughter texted me something once. I don't text a lot, but it was a quote from Byron Katie, this woman in California who's apparently had some sort of enlightenment experience. She said, anytime we're stressed, anytime we're upset, it's a compassionate wake-up call telling us we're lost in the dream. Really useful advice. Anytime we feel tension in the body, a sick feeling in the stomach, or notice our jaws clenched, or any of the other things that we do when we step out of this moment and into our worries and concerns, that's the trigger. That tells us, okay, what's going on here? And you can do what Joko Beck is talking about, just sort of tune in again to sounds around you or to movement or whatever. But you can also just feel those sensations in the body when we're anxious, to know completely what it's like to be anxious. There's all kinds of physical things going on. It's not just one objective experience. It's moving, it's flowing. And if we get out of the initial feeling of, oh, I got to stop feeling this way, this is not good, if we can simply say, oh, okay, what's this? It's that slight shift in our attitude, that feeling of curiosity, that willingness to just take whatever is given and be with it. Totally different experience. If you do this, if you get in the habit, then when things come that are upsetting, that do throw you off, it's an opportunity. You actually can look forward to it. Oh, let me see what happens now. What can I do with this? How quickly, even not how quickly, just can I come back to what's really going on? If it worked to be dead serious and go into a state of alarm when we notice ourselves going off track, if that was an effective strategy, then it would be recommended. You know, beat yourself up more. You're just not beating yourself up enough. Maybe there are people like that. I suppose there probably are. It could stand to whack themselves now and then, but I aspire to be such a person, but I haven't made it yet. Once we reestablish awareness, we see what to do about the situation. Action that arises out of awakened experience is nearly always satisfactory. It works. You may say, that may be true with simple problems, but I doubt it will work with the big, complex problems I face. In fact, however, the process works no matter how, quote, big the problem is. We may not get the solution we were looking for, and the resolution may not be immediate, but we will see what step to take next. Over time, we learn to trust the process, to have faith that things will work out as best they can under the circumstances. This is the difference between faith in life and faith in manipulation. It's unfortunate that manipulating other people and manipulating our feelings works as well as it does. It doesn't work real well, but sometimes we seem to wiggle out of a bad situation by, you know, stretching the truth or cajoling someone. But in the long run, it's not productive. It's not fruitful. It disconnects us from our life. She says, the person who we counted on who didn't come through, the job we failed to get, the physical ailment that worries us, instead of going round and round in our thoughts, worrying about the problem, we reestablish the foundation of our lives in immediate experience, and we will see how to act appropriately. One of the real signals that our worry is getting us nowhere is when we keep thinking the same thoughts over and over and over again. We can go around in this endless circle again and again. At some point, you have to laugh. This is ridiculous. If there's something I haven't thought of that I need to think about, you know, then I need to think in a different way, because all I'm doing is just repeating the same anxious thoughts and manufacturing the same anxious feelings over and over and over again. People can do this for years, for years. It's not uncommon at all. I'm sure many of us have done this. There's a way out. Practice affords us a way out. We need to have faith in it. We need to actually do it. We can't have practice be just a continuation of our worrying and thinking. But it doesn't have to be something, it's not like we have to jump into some weird supernatural realm. We just need to come home. We just need to be here, present, with it. Just the breath. Just the question. There isn't any need to get ahead of ourselves. So many people working on a koan, again and again the question is coming up, you know, well, am I about to get there? When will I get there? Will I ever get there? Waste of time. Total waste of time. Which you'll probably do again. It's just we get a little better, gradually, a little better at moving from what isn't fruitful back to what is. That's all. Little tiny change in direction, done again and again and again, totally changes the character of our life, totally changes our character. It's the same thing. She says, I'm not suggesting that we should act blindly out of mere impulse. We need to be informed to know the obvious things about the problem. We need to use our natural intelligence, our functional thinking. For example, suppose I have a twinge in my tooth. If I begin to think of how I hate dental work, the drilling and the needles and the discomfort, I'll go round and round in my head and create a huge problem for myself. If I return to the foundation of my life in my direct experience, on the other hand, I'll say to myself, well, it's just a twinge right now. I'll keep an eye on it and go about my business. If the twinge persists or gets worse, I'll call the dentist or make an appointment. With that approach, everything falls into place. It isn't denial. It's not feeling a twinge in our tooth and thinking, oh God, I don't want to think about that. I know where that goes. You know, the dentist and the needle and the pain and the expense. I'll keep an eye on it. But right now, it's just a twinge. student says, "The danger for me in returning to my ordinary sensations is that I may block out my anxiety or worry entirely, as if it didn't exist." And of course, that's not really returning to your sensations, because your anxiety is a sensation. How can you block that out? If you are, then you're using practice in the wrong way. It's not about escape. It's about openness. Joko says, "The anxiety is no more than certain thoughts and an accompanying tension or contraction in the body. Returning to our senses means to notice the thoughts for what they are and to be aware of the tension in the body." Okay. Awareness of the tension is, after all, just another physical sensation, along with seeing, smelling, and the like. It sounds crazy to say that when we have a problem, we should listen to the traffic. But if we truly listen, our other senses come to life also. We feel the contraction in our body too. When we do that, something shifts, and how to respond becomes clearer. The real danger is those contractions in the body that we don't feel. That unconscious trauma. One of the big early benefits of practice is just to realize where our tension is. It's not as if we're going to immediately banish it, but just to know, okay, you know, I have a tendency to squeeze my shoulders forward. What's that about? What does that feel like? Student says, "Aren't the senses on a kind of timeshare basis? If we totally listen to a sound, don't we block out smell, taste, and so on? Really listening to the traffic may mean I'm ignoring the rest of my body." Joko says, "That kind of exclusive attention to one mode of sensation is the result of subtle thinking, perhaps an anxious thought that I have to do this or I'm in danger. If we're fully open, we engage all our senses simultaneously." To hear the crickets doesn't require intentionality. The senses come to us without our effort. To breathe doesn't require intentionality. Our breath is there spontaneously. Even working with the koan, we can open to it as opposed to trying to squeeze something out of it. We come to it with an attitude of wonder, an attitude of faith, rather than an attitude of grasping. Takes on life. Student says, "Returning to the senses doesn't always happen quickly with me. If I'm worried about a problem, I may think about it for a week, despite my efforts to pay attention to the traffic or whatever." And Joko says, "Yes, depending upon how long and how well we have practiced, the process does take time. The ability to move quickly is the mark of a practice that has gone on for many years. Some people can hold on to their misery for a long time. They really enjoy it. Someone was telling me recently how much she enjoys her self-righteousness." This is pretty common. Who wants to listen to the traffic when we can enjoy our self-righteousness? We don't want to abandon our patterns, our thoughts of who we are, even when we recognize intellectually that they get us into trouble. So we cling to them and return to them, even after reminding ourselves to come back. We're not ready to trust the process fully, to have faith in our direct experience. It's a big step to really accept that self-righteous anger is a dead end. I, of course, you know, being head of staff at the center, I get to see people work through that quite a bit because there's so many unjust things that happen to people. And immediately, that sense of being right comes up, and it's, it does feel good in a strange kind of way. Hard for people to see that's not going to take you where you want to be. You're completely focusing outside yourself when you look at the faults of others. This world will never stop having imperfect people in it. You're never going to stop being one of them. Skipping ahead a little bit, a student says, "So if one of my tasks while I'm sitting by the stream is to plan the day's menu, that's okay." And Joko says, "Yes, assuming that planning the menu is an appropriate task for that moment, instead of arising out of anxious thoughts about oneself. We just do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. Once we've handled the task, we turn to whatever else is going on. It's okay to narrow attention as needed to undertake a task. That's different from shutting out our life because we are thinking about ourselves, which is an unnecessary psychological impediment. The distinction concerns false emotion versus true emotion. If a remark made to us days ago is still upsetting us, that's false emotion. A true emotion is immediate to the situation. Maybe somebody hits me, or I see somebody in trouble. For a second, I'm upset, and I do something, and it's over. The emotions are a response to a real event. When the event is no longer going on, then the emotions settle back. That's a natural response to life. My wife, who's studying to become a marriage and family counseling therapist, passed something on to me. They've done studies that the life cycle, the lifetime of an emotion, is about 90 seconds. If you're still feeling it a minute and a half later, then you're prolonging it. You're doing something with your thinking to keep it going. And that's where we get in trouble. Nursing our anger. I use that phrase, nursing our anger, for years without really connecting it to the picture of a mother nursing her child. We indulge our anger. We feed it. And the same with all the other negative emotions. Most people run their lives out of false emotion. They carry memories from the past or worries about the future and create upset for themselves. The upset is unrelated to what's happening in the moment. This is the key point. What's going on right now? We're stewing about what happened last week and we can't sleep. Student says, even though the memory is generating false emotion, there is a present sensation in the body. The emotion is stuck in me. I can feel it. And she says, yes, so we notice the accompanying thoughts and feel the tension of the body, and when we do that enough times, the blockage eases and something shifts. Another student says, if my day is particularly busy, a lot of anxiety can build up and it feels more comfortable to be daydreaming. Is that wrong? Duh. She says, if you do it, you do it. The problem is that by daydreaming, we cut ourselves off from life. When we're cut off from life, we overlook things and we get into trouble. It's as though we're floating down a turbulent stream. Here and there are rocks and tree stumps projecting out of the water. Looking at them may make us anxious, but if we ignore them and instead just gaze at the beautiful clouds in the sky, sooner or later we're in the drink. Paying attention to the white water and rocks may feel scary, but it's a very good idea nonetheless. We have to be willing to face up to the fear. Spacing out is not any more productive or helpful than stewing and worrying. This is denial. It's a middle ground. We give to everything its due. Sometimes it helps to stop. If you're one of these people who tends to zone out and deal with anxiety by retreating into daydreams or thoughts about other things, it's good from time to time to just check in and say, is there anything I should be dealing with? Do I have responsibilities that I need to attend to? Is there anything I've buried that I need to deal with? For other people, those things are just in the mind constantly, and they need to find a way to say, enough. I've looked at this problem from every angle. I've decided on a course of action. Let it rest. Well, our time is more than up. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.